making TV special.
Donuts. Made with creamy butter.
And you know what that means?
It's happening. I can feel it.
Yep.
Get live, get crunk, get hype, get up, get right, get your ass involved, yo. Get live, get crunk, get hype, get up, get right, get your ass involved, yo. I move swiftly while you cast moves lightly. You think you're cruising crazy because your jewels are shining? Obviously, you ain't met a dude like me. I'm in it for the long haul, but y'all pack the small load. Okay, play the wall, yo, and watch you bond with it. Can't move from the bricks, so you ain't doing nothing. I'm trying to expand the land where I am, so I got a plan that demands a hand from my damn band. Quit the fiction claiming that you're living in the streets when you're only pitching, reminiscing on a vivid dream. You getting cream to get involved. Why don't you try hitting the scene with a style that's more evolved? When I get access, I'ma revolve with the access around the planet and resolve all the damage. I know it's hard to understand it, let alone manage it, but don't sit on the issue if you ain't standing it. Still fetal, what? I got a clear vision, you're staring through the peephole. So get your bifocals or keep your mind local. Like satellite photos, my sights stay global. I'm writing to show you this hectic life that I go through and how I'm about to change it with a mic and my vocals. Yo, these rap singers is wingless, I had to fly solo. So you can't speak on me like antisocials. Uh-oh, you stalling cats better keep it moving, or the crowd will quit on you like a resolution. I practice execution like an army of Cubans, but I ain't shooting, I just follow through on what I'm doing. So stop speaking like your album is a secret, how you don't wanna leak it. I'll believe it when I see it.
Now get your ass off the wall.
All my people on the west, get your ass involved. All my people on the east, get your ass involved. All my people down south, get your ass involved. All my people up north, get your ass involved. All my people on the map, get your ass involved. It don't matter where you at, get your ass involved.
Local positive hip hop from Diesel P. That track's called Get Involved. And we're going to, here on this B-side episode 103 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. Coming to you for the first time on one of these B-side episodes from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org. My man, DJ Cliff, wasn't able to make it in today, so I'm taking his spot because there's more than enough news to go over. But kicking off the show, that would hopefully make my man DJ Cliff proud. MySpace.com/DJ Cliff, KLYPH. But yeah, that was Diesel P, local Portland positive hip hop. Get involved. So once again, let me welcome you to 103B, MediaMonarchy.com, live from the Portland Radio Authority. We're going to go over a good bit of what I try and do on these B-sides is things that I can't or don't want to get into on the main show. But all the schedules are all strange and everything's all mixed up, and I realize they both come together and it seems ridiculous to do a B-side moments before I do the next episode. But I'm just taking it as it comes and trying to do the best I can. So hang tight with me, bear with me, but you're going to get a lot of news and you're going to get hours of Media Monarchy, coming to you today, December 19th, 2008. So right now at the top of the page, atop of a lot of pages, Deep Throat, Mark Felt, dead at 95. So, of course, we'll go to the source, the Washington Post. W. Mark Felt, Sr., the associate director of the FBI during the Watergate scandal, who, better known as Deep Throat, became the most famous anonymous source in American history, died Thursday at the age of 95. He died at about 12:45 p.m. at a hospice near his home in Santa Rosa, California, where he'd been living since August. Felt was, quote, fine that morning and was joking with his caregiver, according to his daughter Joan Felt. She said in a phone interview that her father ate a big breakfast before remarking that he was tired and going to sleep. He slipped away, she said. As the second highest official in the FBI under longtime director J. Edgar Hoover and interim director L. Patrick Gray, Felt detested the Nixon administration's attempt to subvert the Bureau's investigation into the complex crimes and cover-ups known as the Watergate scandal that, of course, ultimately led to the resignation of President Richard Milhouse Nixon. Felt secretly guided Washington Post reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein as they pursued the story of the 1972 break-in of the Democratic National Committee's headquarters at the Watergate office buildings and later revelations of the Nixon administration's campaign of spying and sabotage against its perceived political enemies. Felt insisted on remaining completely anonymous or on, quote, deep background, end quote. A Post editor dubbed him Deep Throat, a bit of wordplay based on the title of a pornographic movie of the time. The source's existence, but not his identity, became known in Woodward and Bernstein's 1974 book, All the President's Men, and in the subsequent film version, in which actor Hal Holbrook played the charismatic but shadowy source.
May 31st, 2005, the day America learned the details of one of its biggest secrets. Better known to the public as Deep Throat, Mark Felt, the former associate director of the FBI, revealed he was the man who helped bring down the Nixon administration.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office.
Thursday night at the age of 95, Felt passed away. While the FBI's second-in-command, Felt provided key information to Washington Post reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein that eventually saw the resignation of President Richard Nixon in 1974. For more than 30 years, Felt denied he was the source who connected the White House to the June 1972 break-in at the Democratic National Committee headquarters.
He wouldn't talk, and my colleague Carl Bernstein and I and others at the Washington Post kept our word. He was insistent that we not disclose, and I think we wanted to protect that principle.
Then, in May of 2005, he decided to break his silence.
Big grin. Big grin. Big grin. I don't even remember, but he's happy. He's happy about it.
Critics called Felt a traitor for betraying President Nixon, while supporters hailed him as a hero for blowing the whistle on a corrupt administration. Ultimately, his daughter convinced him to reveal his identity, arguing his secret could pay off the family debts. The two men who held his secret, Woodward and Bernstein, had agreed to never reveal their deep secret until either Deep Throat outed himself or died. John O'Connor, the family friend who wrote the 2005 Vanity Fair article uncovering Felt's secret, says Felt died of congestive heart failure. Brian Thomas, The Associated Press.
Mark Deep Throat Felt, dead at 95. I know when he came out, it always seemed to me the doubter, the conspiracy theorist that they seemed to push out some doddering old man that said, "Now's the throat." And I haven't had time to dig into any of the alternative theories about Deep Throat. I feel like I've even heard that it was George Bush Sr. at some point, so God knows. But the research is there for you. We're going to shift gears, but to another obituary. A very different kind of obituary. Posted up last Saturday, December 13th. However, she died the Thursday before that, the 11th. Bondage Queen Betty Page dies at 85. This from Reuters. Betty Page, one of America's most photographed pinup girls during the 1950s, died in L.A. on Thursday, December 11th, from pneumonia. She was 85. Page was a ubiquitous sight during the 1950s, propelled to stardom when she posed for Playboy as Miss January 1955. Soon, her image was gracing playing cards, record albums, and bedroom posters across the country. She stopped modeling in 1957, retreated from the public spotlight, and turned to religion. She enjoyed a renaissance of sorts in the 80s as a new generation of fans became obsessed with her legacy. Her agent, Mark Rosler, said Page was admitted to an L.A. area hospital 4 weeks ago. She never regained consciousness after suffering a heart attack earlier this month. With her dark bangs, alluring blue-gray eyes, and wide smile, Page cultivated an innocent girl-next-door persona. The one-time school teacher was nice, but clearly also naughty. Some of her photos featured spanking and bondage. Betty Page embodied the stereotypical wholesomeness of the 50s and the hidden sexuality straining beneath the surface. Authors Karen Essex and James Swanson wrote in their 96 book, Betty Page, The Life of a Pinup Legend. Page professed to be mystified by all the attention, saying she never felt particularly attractive and had to wear a lot of makeup to cover up her large pores. After she found God, she was initially ashamed of having posed nude. Quote, "But now most of the money I've got is because I posed in the nude," she told Playboy in 2007. "So I'm not ashamed of it now, but I still don't understand it."
Who's there? Who's that? Looking for someone?
You want to keep it down?
Who are you?
I'm the neighbor downstairs. I hate to complain, but hey!
I'm right above you. Join me on the roof.
The roof?
Uh-huh.
Last time I heard that line was in 76.
You two aren't the only ones who enjoy doing the dirty hula. Let's get together for that special tingle.
Betty's early years growing up in Tennessee during the Depression gave no hint she'd someday become a pinup legend. I got a chance to ask Betty about her past, but under one condition, that we preserve her memory and not show her as she looks today.
I always got up mimicking poses of the movie stars in the magazines, models and movie stars, and that was my first beginnings of posing. I had no idea then I'd ever be a pinup model.
But it was after Betty graduated college that she got offered the chance of a lifetime, a Hollywood screen test.
They tried to make me up to look like Joan Crawford. They bunched my hair way out on the sides, penciled my eyebrows, big, long eyebrows, way up high like she used to wear, and a great big wide mouth, twice as wide as mine. And I hardly recognized myself when I saw the screen test.
Betty's first shot at Hollywood stardom fizzled. So in 1950, she headed to New York City, where she got a job as a secretary. It wasn't long before her beauty caught the eye of amateur photographers in the local camera clubs.
I didn't pose for them in a nude at first. I wore bikinis, and I never thought I was doing anything wrong when I started posing nude even for the camera club. Because after all, I don't believe God disapproves of nudity. He put Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, naked as jaybirds, and they would have probably been naked all their lives if they hadn't disobeyed him and he ran them out of the garden.
Pretty soon, Betty's popularity spread beyond the limited circles of the amateur camera clubs. She began modeling for scores of men's magazines. And in 1955, she was one of the first centerfolds for a brand new magazine called Playboy. Plenty of people began to notice there was something special about Betty Page.
The late Betty Page. I recalled, and I had forgotten about it, but I saw an interesting film a couple years ago called The Notorious Betty Page that's worth checking out with Gretchen Mol and Lily Taylor. But we're going to shift gears into a strange little story from the Associated Press. It's little Adolf Hitler and the Cake War. The father of 3-year-old Adolf Hitler Campbell denied a birthday cake with the child's full name on it by one New Jersey supermarket is asking for a little tolerance. Heath Campbell and his wife Deborah are upset not only with the decision made by the Greenwich, New Jersey ShopRite, but with an outpouring of angry internet postings in response to a local newspaper article about the flare-up over frosting. and of course with an art with a link to the original article for you. I think people need to take their heads out of the cloud they've been in and start focusing on the future, not on the past, Heath Campbell said Tuesday in an interview conducted in Easton on the other side of the Delaware River from where the family lives in Hunterdon County, New Jersey. There's a new president, and he says it's time for a change. Well, then it's time for a change, the 35-year-old continued. They need to accept a name. A name's a name. The kid isn't going to grow up and do what Hitler did. Deborah Campbell, 25, said she phoned in her order to the ShopRite in Jersey. When she told the bakery department she wanted her son's name spelled out, she was told to talk to a supervisor who denied the request. A store manager at ShopRite referred questions to a corporate spokeswoman who did not immediately return a phone message. But spokeswoman Karen Melita told the Easton Express Times that the store considered Campbell's request inappropriate. The Campbells ultimately got their cake decorated at Walmart in Pennsylvania. Thanks, Walmart. So Heath Campbell and his three-year-old boy, Adolf Hitler Campbell, and I think if you follow some of the links in there to NJ.com, New York Daily News, and others, believe he has other children with the name of Aryan Nation, and but he says he's not a racist guy, and when they got the cake for their birthday party, there were black kids there, so little Adolf Hitler Campbell in the cake war. So anytime bizarre neo-Nazi bullshit spills out, we need to cover it, if only to expose and ridicule. Another interesting case. And again, perhaps on these B-sides, I'll focus on some of the lighter news, some of the fluffier things, but interesting nonetheless in the world of media and culture and politics and conspiracies and cover-ups, all the things that MediaMonarchy.com tries to cover. John Walsh's most wanted case solved after decades. This from the Deutsche Press Agentur, DPA. One of the best-known and longest-running child murder cases in the United States has been solved. Police in Hollywood, Florida, identified Tuesday a deceased serial killer and pedophile, Otis Toole, O-T-T-I-S-T-O-O-L-E, as the man who abducted, murdered, and decapitated six-year-old Adam Walsh. Toole was a convicted murderer who died in prison in 1996 and had long been the suspect in the case that elevated the boy's father, John Walsh, to national fame. For 27 years, we've been asking who could take a six-year-old boy and murder him and decapitate him. Who? We needed to know, Walsh says at a press conference with the police, tears streaming down his face. And today, we know. The not knowing has been a torture, but that journey is over, he said, also according to ABC News. His wife and their three children were present. Walsh, of course, has been a tireless advocate for families or missing or murdered children. He helped create the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, missingkids.com, and became the host of a television show that you might know called America's Most Wanted.
Now to a dramatic turn in the story of John Walsh. As you know, he's made a career out of helping police solve crimes on his TV show America's Most Wanted. But there was one case he couldn't crack, the murder of his own son, Adam. Now, more than a quarter century after the six-year-old disappeared, police in South Florida have declared the case solved. Here's Kelly Corbiella.
They're the words John and Revee Walsh have been longing to hear for 27 years.
It is our determination and conclusion that Otis Toole was the abductor and murderer of Adam Walsh.
A definitive answer as to who killed their six-year-old son, Adam Walsh, the smiling boy in the baseball cap. It was Otis Toole, a drifter and violent pedophile who died in prison 12 years ago.
This is a wonderful, wonderful day in spite of why we're here.
For 27 years, we've been asking, who could take a six-year-old boy and murder him and decapitate him? Who? We needed to know.
Adam Walsh disappeared from a Sears store in Hollywood, Florida in 1981. He had been there with his mother.
Revee said, Adam, I'll be in the lamp department 2 hours over. And he said, Mommy, I know where that is. And 10 minutes later, she returned and he was gone.
2 weeks after he vanished, fishermen found the boy's decapitated head in a canal more than 100 miles away. The rest of his body was never found.
The next of kin is being notified at this point in time.
Toole, a serial killer, was a suspect from the beginning, but police acknowledged missteps in the investigation, losing bloody carpet from Toole's car, then the car itself. Despite that, police say the circumstantial evidence is overwhelming.
This is a day that's long overdue. Truly is.
After Adam's murder, John Walsh became an activist for missing children, launching a TV show to track down violent criminals.
This is a bad day for you.
And pushing for laws to help parents.
It's now my high honor to sign the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act.
Today, he had a message for those parents.
Don't give up hope. Don't give up hope.
Walsh said there is no closure, only justice, and his family finally has it. Callie Cobiella, CBS News, Hollywood, Florida.
John Walsh's Most Wanted, finally captured, and I was mispronouncing the name. It's Otis Tool. So, from one supposedly solved mystery to a different supposedly unsolved mystery, three new books offer competing versions of JFK's assassination. This from the New York Observer. What can we hope to gain from a new book about the JFK assassination? Surely not that it reveals some definitive truth about the events in Dallas, since with every passing year, with each frustrating release of declassified information, it becomes clear that no such revelation will ever be forthcoming. Rather, the best such a book can offer is a narrative that is plausible and in some way resonant, a story that provides the consolations of fiction rather than fact. If we can't have the truth, then at least give us a myth we can believe in, a story with villains and heroes with tragedy and some sense of redemption. So, the three new books, first two of which are very new, and I hadn't heard of them yet, the third of which we've been covering quite some time, and we'll get to that in just a moment. The first, Brothers in Arms, claims that it depicts the events surrounding the assassination in a narrative nonfiction format using techniques of the most highly readable novels. Written by veteran investigative reporter Gus Russo in collaboration with novelist and screenwriter Stephen Moulton, M-O-L-T-O-N, this elegantly composed book depicts those few seconds in Dallas as being the culmination of a blood feud between two sets of brothers, the Castro brothers and the Kennedy brothers. Book number two, Legacy of Secrecy, proves in many ways to be a mirror image of Brothers in Arms. Written by veteran Kennedy investigator Lamar Waldron and assisted again by Air America host Portland's own Tom Hartman, it asserts that Oswald was in fact an anti-Castro agent involved in a CIA plot to overthrow the Cuban leader, which was slated to take place just days after Kennedy's killing. The third book, as we're jumping through the article from the New York Observer, The Unsolved Mystery. For its part, James W. Douglas's JFK and the Unspeakable puts forward a scenario in which JFK was cut down by a CIA-administered plot that used Oswald as a patsy. Mr. Douglas, a longtime peace activist, believes Kennedy was murdered by shadowy forces because he was in the process of renouncing the Cold War and all its toxic legacies. The arms race, Vietnam, anti-Castro campaign, even predatory capitalism in the form of Big Steel. Also, of course, as we've noted on the show, in the form of getting around the Federal Reserve. An interesting comment was posted to my story here on MediaMonarchy.com from someone named Tim Fleming, and I'll read it for you. Calling Gus Russo an investigative reporter is like awarding the Oscar to porn star John Holmes. This guy wouldn't know the facts if they accosted him, beat him senseless, kidnapped him, and held him for ransom. It's utterly laughable that he blames the Castro brothers for orchestrating the plot to kill JFK. I suppose Fidel convinced the covert operatives of Operation Mongoose to pull it off. Mongoose, of course, the CIA's plot to kill Castro, but instead of gunning for the beard, they were all photographed in Dallas on November 21st through the 22nd, 1963. Another photo, of course, featured on the cover of Daniel Hopsicker's Barry and the Boys, with Barry Seal, famed drug runner, Porter Goss, Felix Rodriguez, other CIA operatives. But back to the comment. And of course, the Castros arranged to have Secret Service agent Henry Ribka ordered off the death limo as it was leaving Love Field and have the rest of the agents stand down as the shots were fired in Dealey Plaza. And of course, you can see the video of Henry Ribka being ordered off the runners of JFK's car. And as the car pulls away, he keeps shrugging his shoulders as if literally saying, "What the fuck? Why are you taking me off the car?" So Google, YouTube, Secret Service stand down, JFK, and then you'll get it. Oh, yes. Fidel somehow managed to alter the wounds of the president between the time the body left Dallas and arrived at Bethesda. And the Castros made sure the body was hijacked from Parkland before an autopsy, mandated, of course, by Texas law, could be performed. But first, of course, they had to arrange, through their emissaries Michael Payne of Bell Helicopter and millionaire oilman and Texas school book depository owner D.H. Byrd, to get Oswald that job which overlooked the president's route so that he could be framed for the shooting. And it was clever how the Castros maneuvered Ruby into position at just the right time to kill the patsy. And it certainly, it was Castro's agents who appointed the Warren Commission to cover the whole thing up. And for the last 45 years, Fidel has somehow convinced the CIA to withhold evidence. My God, the Castros were busy in 1963, and what power they have wielded since. Who says a third world banana republic can't orchestrate a massive plot that kills the leader of the free world and stifles all investigative arms of the most powerful nations of the world, sworn enemy of communist Cuba? Legacy of Secrecy, the second book, is almost as hilarious. Hartman and Waldron blame the mob for the whole thing. If you want a cogent, serious read about the assassination and a brave, logical exploration of the true motivation behind the killing, read James Douglas's JFK and the Unspeakable. The establishment will try to smear him as a peace activist. God knows there's nothing worse than somebody who works for peace. But he's got it right. Unlike Rousseau, Douglas points fingers at the people who genuinely had the means, motives, and opportunity. Tim Fleming, author of Murder of an American Nazi. That's at eloquentbooks.com and also at leftlooking.blogspot.com. So, an excellent comment, and I couldn't have said it better myself, from Tim Fleming, posted at the bottom of the story, The Unsolved Mystery. Now, of course, you can hit the link in there about JFK and the Unspeakable back to June of this year when James Douglas was in Portland reading and speaking and taking questions at PALS. And recorded the interview. It's up there for you. Hundreds of downloads up on archive.org. Photos of me and James Douglas where I'm talking to him about Obama not being a threat to the system, as everyone else in the hall was so concerned. And again, this is June 2008. But I digress, and let's move on. And of course, it's always an easy move from JFK to 9/11. 9/11 updates, lawsuits, liability, chat logs, and flukes. First, from the Associated Press, New York City ruling limits airlines' liability for 9/11, or, of course, Lucky Larry wanted more. A judge says developer Larry Silverstein cannot recover more from the aviation industry than the $2.8 billion value of the World Trade Center if his lawsuits succeed. Federal Judge Alvin Hellerstein made the determination in a ruling filed last Thursday. The decision carried Wednesday's date. Hellerstein rejected Silverstein's claims that his company would be entitled to as much as $16.2 billion from American Airlines, United Airlines, and other aviation defendants. A lawsuit on behalf of Silverstein's companies claimed that negligence by the airlines allowed the terrorists to hijack planes that struck the Twin Towers on 9/11. The aviation defendants denied liability. A call to Silverstein's lawyer wasn't immediately returned. And of course, hit the links and read about Larry Silverstein. From Raw Story, family's 9/11 liability suit could go to trial. A federal district court judge in Manhattan said Monday that he will decide whether or not a suit brought against U.S. Airlines by families of several victims of 9/11 attacks may proceed. "I'd like some truth and accountability, and I want the public to hear it," said Mike Lowe, L-O-W, whose daughter Sarah was a flight attendant on American Airlines Flight 11. Lowe spoke with the Boston Globe for a Monday report with a link for you. The families of Barbara Keating, Mark Bavis, and Sarah Lowe asked Judge Alvin Hellerstein to allow their full liability suit against airlines and security companies in Boston to progress to trial. The suit alleges that security at Dulles, Newark, and Logan was negligent in allowing the alleged terrorists to board the flights. To date, no family members of September 11th victims have had a day in court. To date, no family members of 9/11 victims have had a day in court. Over 3,000 families have instead accepted lucrative settlements from the Federal Victims Compensation Fund, with the average figure hovering in the range of $2 million. So hopefully that will progress. Another bit of good news, this from the Staten Island Advance Clinic for 9/11 Responders opens. A clinic for World Trade Center first responders was formally opened in West Brighton on December 15th, a joint venture between Richmond University Medical Center and Mount Sinai Medical Center in Manhattan, where some 1,400 Staten Islanders already have sought treatment for illnesses related to exposure to toxins and depression. But remember, Christine Todd Whitman and the EPA said that the air was safe to breathe. A little mainstream media toady that always pops up and always seems to be connected to important information, whether he's the one writing the stories about wiretapping and other things. New York Times writer James Risen, R-I-S-E-N, in a recent interview with the American News Project, says that history will view 9/11 as a fluke.
Bush has said that one of his greatest accomplishments is that he's kept Americans safe. The question is there a genuine, day-to-day, serious, considerable threat, terrorist threat to Americans?
When I think about this issue, I was thinking of the joke I heard years ago where this guy put a sign in his backyard that said, "No elephants allowed." And his neighbors, after a month, came and said, "Why did you have a sign that says, 'No elephants allowed'?" And he said, "Well, you haven't seen any elephants, have you?" I think the basic storyline is going to be, in the long run, that 9/11 was a fluke. They got lucky. We weren't really ready or prepared to deal with an operation like that. It was more of a failure of imagination. I think today, if Bush was being honest, you kind of forced him to truly be honest and say, okay, if you knew there was no weapons of mass destruction, if you knew there was no connection to Al-Qaeda, and if you knew that this war would cost as much as it has in lives and money, and you knew how damaging this would be to your presidency, would you still invade Iraq? I just cannot believe he really would have done it.
New York Times writer James Risen saying 9/11 was a fluke in an interview, and you can watch the whole thing with the American News Project, AmericanNewsProject.com. However, a good rebuttal from 911blogger.com points out that the no elephant sign is a funny and appropriate anecdote, but it seems, at the least, premature without a full investigation to come to the conclusion that 9/11 was a failure of imagination. When 70% of the families' questions were ignored and haven't been addressed by the mainstream media responsibly, unlike drunk driving celebrities and missing white women, and more info has come out since, including info on what's being withheld. It's also, of course, interesting, especially when this is the guy who broke the story on the NSA warrantless wiretapping, which we'll get to a little bit later. An interesting one as well from 911blogger.com. What do NORAD's 9/11 computer chat logs reveal? That's an interesting one to dive into, but we're going to jump to thinkprogress.org. And they're just busting out all the greatest hits, all the classics, all the chestnuts. I joke about it all the time, but here they are saying it seriously. White House spokesman Tony Fratto reiterating the ridiculous, easily debunked line that no one could have anticipated terrorists flying into buildings before 9/11. The Bush White House is in full throttle spin mode, attempting to repair the president's badly tarnished legacy. So, on Fox News, they, of course, lent a hand in the effort to revise history. In an interview with White House press spokesman Tony Fratto, F-R-A-T-T-O, Fox anchor John Scott claimed that prior to 9/11, quote, nobody was thinking, end quote, that terrorists could fly planes into buildings as an act of terrorism. Fratto, of course, agreed.
Back to the 9/11 attacks, which happened, after all, fairly early in this president's first term. I mean, nobody was thinking that there would be terrorists flying 767s into buildings at that point. And, you know, these days, I guess you have to broaden the scope of what's possible, what might happen out there.
That's true. I mean, no one could have anticipated that kind of attack, or very, very few people. We don't know what the next one will be. We try to think of the unthinkable out there and be ready for it, but we're also focused on something, as you know, John, in this administration, trying to find those individuals who are likely to carry out whatever kind of attack is before they can actually do it.
Now, at least Fratto does point out, you know, no one was thinking, or at least very few people. Those very few people, of course, would be folks like the National Reconnaissance Office, running drills of hijacked planes crashing into buildings in Washington. Of course, we've noted time and time again at the big G8 debacle in Genoa in Italy in 2001, they had anti-aircraft missile batteries set up because they were worried about kamikaze planes, and on and on and on. So it's funny, something that I make fun of still gets brought up as a serious point. Lastly, on these latest 9/11 updates, lawsuits, liability, chat logs, and flukes, it's the amazing story of April Gallup. I first heard her story thanks to my man Richard Andrew Grove at 8thestate.com and 911synchronicity.com. However, she is stepping it up. Career Army Specialist sues Rumsfeld and Cheney, saying no evacuation order was given on 9/11. This from Raw Story. Again, what myself and others believe, they're closet truthers at Raw Story. A career Army specialist who survived the attacks of 9/11 claims that no evacuation was ordered inside the Pentagon, despite flight controllers calling in warnings of approaching hijacked aircraft nearly 20 minutes before the building was struck. According to a timeline of the attacks, the Federal Aviation Administration notified NORAD that American Airlines Flight 77 had been hijacked at 9:24 a.m. and the Pentagon was not struck until 9:43. On behalf of Specialist April Gallup, G-A-L-L-O-P, who served in the Network Infrastructure Services Agency as an administrative specialist, California attorney William Veale, V-E-A-L-E, has filed a civil suit against former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, Vice President Dick Cheney, and former U.S. Air Force General Richard Myers, who was acting chairman of the Joint Chiefs, if not on 9/11. This lawsuit alleges they engaged in conspiracy to facilitate the terrorist attacks and purposefully failed to warn those inside the Pentagon, contributing to injuries she and her two-month-old son incurred. The XGI plaintiff alleges she has been denied government support since then because she raised painful questions about the inexplicable failure of military defenses at the Pentagon that day, and especially the failure of officials to warn and evacuate the occupants of the building when they knew the attack was imminent. That said by Veale in a media advisory. Specialist Gallup also says she heard two loud explosions and does not believe that a Boeing 757 hit the building. Her son sustained a serious brain injury and Gallup herself was knocked unconscious after the roof collapsed onto her office. The suit also named additional unknown persons who had foreknowledge of the attacks. What they don't want is this for this to go into discovery, said Gallup's attorney, Mr. Veale, speaking to Raw Story. If we can make it past their initial motion to dismiss these claims and we get the power of subpoena, then we've got a real shot at getting to the bottom of this. We've got the law on our side. There is a link, and you can read the full text of the lawsuit. However, interestingly enough, back on September 18th of this year, April Gallup talked about her experiences at the Pentagon with Alex Jones.
September 11, 2001, I was returning back from maternity leave, and with that comes getting situated. I was asked to take care of some paperwork prior to taking my son to daycare. So I said, yes, of course, to do what they said, but honestly, I didn't think that they were actually going to clear my son. to get through. But somehow on that particular day, he was able to get clear to go in the back with me. When I sat down at the desk, I pulled out the keyboard, I went to touch the computer, and as soon as I touched the button, boom. And then, of course, the rest is history. Now, from an insider's perspective, because it happened simultaneously, when I touched the keyboard, when I touched the button on the screen, I thought I triggered something. I mean, that's just, you know, by virtue of what took place. And, of course, being on the inside, there were no alarms, no hints with everything that was going on. And they're always watching, you know, news around the world 24/7 in the Pentagon. There were no alarms, no hints, no warnings, nothing. So, you know, that was another, wow, how come? And, of course, you know, I eventually came to and got out of the debris. And I locked my shoes, and I bring this part up very crucial because I walked barefooted out with my son. And I didn't see, you know, various types of debris or, you know, anything to that nature that would cause me to think, wow, I was in a bomb, that's a plane. So I was quite surprised. And then when I was told, and as I continued to relive the incident, I tried to see how it was possible. You know, I tried to rationalize the situation. After I was given the information. I mean, you could see that you could see where inside the computer, they were still burning. I guess stuff, I don't know what the inside of the stuff in the ceiling was. That it all came down. There was still some, office, I don't know if it was desk equipment or whatever it was all piled on top of each other. So it seemed it was more like we were blown and then covered under just debris. The metal desk weren't moved that much from what I saw, but that was it.
That's just a few moments of April Gallup's fascinating interview back on September 18th on the Alex Jones Show. She is now suing Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Myers for prior knowledge, and specifically for not evacuating the Pentagon. We will watch that closely. Now, let's turn to the realm of the speculative. And of course, debunking the debunking the debunking. This is from ABC News. They have an article called "What's Behind Internet Conspiracy Empires?" I have this posted up under the headline, ABC News says, "Conspiracy theorists are mentally ill." As we note, again from InfoWars, they note, the lengths to which ABC goes to convince us that people who believe the government pulled off 9/11 and had Kennedy assassinated are akin to the guy who thinks the postal worker is after him. And it has, of course, filed this report under Health, Mind, and Mood News. So, what's behind internet conspiracy empires from ABC News? A man standing on the street corner with a sign reading, "The lizard people rule you all," or "My neighbors are spying on me for the government," isn't likely to get many supporters. But give that man a website template or let him produce some slick videos on YouTube, and lo and behold, he may have thousands of people across the world supporting him. Such is the story of several extraordinarily popular conspiracy theorists and theories online today. Take the victims of gang stalking, a subculture of people who think their friends and neighbors are all secret government spies ready to turn them over to the authorities. The movement has recently spawned gang stalking support groups, forums, and advice websites like gangstalkingworld.com. Or take the former journalist and BBC sports announcer David Icke, for example. Icke was laughed out of the public eye in the early 90s when he started wearing only turquoise and explaining that voices had sent him on an important mission to save the Earth. Decades later, Icke has written books, has fans in 47 countries, and can gather a crowd of 2,500 people in his city simply by posting a date for a lecture on his website. The cornerstone of Icke's theories is that a malicious race of lizard people, the shadowy elite, rules the world and all its political leaders primarily by controlling the media and orchestrating fear-mongering catastrophes such as 9/11. Icke said he already has speeches lined up for 2009 in LA, Mexico, Croatia, New Zealand, and Australia. I knew about the mainstream media and that the mainstream media has a stunning level of myopia so that it only is which the mainstream will be presented. What the internet has done is that it's allowed information to flow outside the myopia. The internet has been absolutely essential. The internet has always been a forum for fringe ideas, but success like Ike's and subcultures built on paranoid theories like gang stalkers points to an understudied corner in psychiatry. Who are the people who believe such theories in the quiet of their homes? And what does such behavior mean for a person teetering on the edge of mental illness? It's not an area that has been studied very well, says Angus McDonald, a spokesperson for the mental health charity NARSAD, N-A-R-S-A-D, and an associate professor of psychology at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. You can go to narsad.org. But that's, of course, if you're paranoid crazy. As we note, generally in mainstream media debunking, they use the straw man tactics. They paint everything with wide strokes and put it all together so that if you believe that there are important unanswered questions about 9/11 or anthrax or any number of things, you must also believe that there are alien lizard people and you're insane. The straw man. A good friend of mine who's back east, I think she's always pulled back and forth between the well-meaning liberal folks who don't really pay that much attention to what's going on versus the other extreme, and that's those who pretty much believe every conspiracy theory. So I had this story posted up, she sent me, and I was like, you don't believe in lizard people, do you? And when I last talked to her, I was able to reassure her, no, I don't believe in the lizard people. I don't doubt that there are other life forms out there. I've just never seen anything convincing. But that's how they do it. If you think 9/11 was an inside job, you must think that the lizard people run the world or that your mailman is spying on you. Again, all these new things that are actually real, we are being tracked and traced and spied on everywhere. But if you say you don't like it, you're nuts. Or it doesn't exist. So since ABC News posted that up under their health heading, that'll ease us right into my next heading on EnviroHealth, death maps, data banks, transplants, etc. First, from the UPI, U.S. Natural Hazard Death Map is produced. Scientists using nationwide data collected since 1970 have produced a map depicting natural hazard mortality across the United States. Susan Cutter and Kevin Borden from the University of South Carolina said their map represents a county-level representation of the likelihood of dying as the result of natural events such as floods, earthquakes, or extreme weather. This work will enable research and emergency management practitioners to examine hazard deaths through a geographic lens. Using this as a tool to identify areas with higher than average hazard deaths can justify allocation of resources to these areas with the goal of reducing loss of life. Cutter and Borden found hazard mortality most prominent in the southern part of the nation, where most people were killed by various severe weather hazards and tornadoes. Other areas of elevated risk are the northern Great Plains, where heat and drought were the biggest killers, and in the western mountains with winter weather and flooding deaths. Heat and drought ranked highest among the hazard categories, causing 19.6% of total deaths, closely followed by severe summer weather, 18.8%, and winter weather, 18.1%. The map is featured in the International Journal of Health Geographics. And of course, the link for you, you can download the full PDF and read about the U.S. Natural Hazard Death Map. And of course, there's more from Scientific American. And I posted up one little shot of the map for you. And it looks like the southwest, the extreme southwest of the United States, seems to be the safest. And where I live right now and where I used to live is kind of in the middle. It's kind of that gray shade. So don't lose your death map. Naturalnews.com points out the bill that no one noticed. But not everyone missed it. I gave you the flashback link. MediaMonarchy.com covered this in May of 2008. The National DNA Data Bank. In April 2008, President Bush signed into law S-1858, which allows the federal government to screen the DNA of all newborn babies in the U.S. Thank you, Christopher Dodd, our great liberal champion. This National DNA Data Bank was to be implemented within 6 months, meaning that this collection is now being carried out. Congressman Ron Paul states that this bill is the first step towards the establishment of a national DNA database. S-1858, known as the Newborn Screening Saves Lives Act of 2007, is justified as a national contingency plan in that it represents preparation for any sort of public health emergency. The bill states that the federal government should, quote, continue to carry out, coordinate, and expand research in newborn screening, maintain a central clearinghouse of current information on newborn screening, ensuring that the clearinghouse is available on the internet and is updated at least quarterly. Sections of the bill also make it clear that DNA may be used in genetic experiments and tests. And of course, there are copious links for you. You can go to govtrack.us, read the whole bill for yourself. S-1858, the Newborn Screening Saves Lives Act of 2007, brought to you by Christopher Dodd. National DNA Database. Jumping across the pond to the Times Online, but of course this affects us at home, and we'll get to that. Mystery illness paralyzes girl given cervical cancer jab. A 12-year-old schoolgirl has been left paralyzed from the waist down by a mystery illness that came on 30 minutes after she was given the new anti-cervical cancer jab. Ashley Cave suffered dizziness and headaches soon after the vaccination at her school and then deteriorated rapidly, collapsing several times over the following days. A week later, she was admitted to the hospital after losing all strength in her legs, and 2 months on, there has been no improvement. Her mother, Cheryl, 37, from Aintree, Merseyside, is blaming her daughter's condition on the human papilloma virus jab, HPV, which was introduced in Britain in September as part of a government-funded vaccination program. Jumping down on the article a little bit, in America, where an immunization program using a similar product, Gardasil, began more than a year earlier, there have been dozens of serious adverse events reported in which a link to the vaccination is suspected. And of course, numerous links also to the Daily Mail, as well as flashback links, as we've been covering Gardasil on MediaMonarchy.com since at least December 2007, and I'm sure it's been older than that. A quick one from the BBC, and there's a video that you can check out. Sorting Sellafield. Inventions aid nuclear cleanup. Sellafield, of course, the noted UK nuclear site. S-E-L-L-A field, Sellafield. Of course, noted in song by Kraftwerk on their Radioactivity record. Sellafield's reactors and reprocessing bunkers are being decommissioned 6 decades after the plant began life. It made plutonium for nuclear weapons and generated electricity for the national grid. The Nuclear Research Laboratory's Fiona Raymond gives a guided tour of the plant's new research center. That is what you can find in the video. The lab has been designed to reinvigorate the UK's nuclear industry amid a review of how much electricity should be deployed by nuclear power stations. The flashback, also dealing with Sellafield, back to April of 2007 on MediaMonarchy.com, UK used humans in secret radioactive tests. Moving to Fox News, scientists call Associated Press report on global warming hysteria. Scientists skeptical of the assertion that climate change is the result of man's activities are criticizing a recent AP report on global warming, calling it irrational hysteria, horrifically bad, and incredibly biased. They say the report, which was published last Monday, contains several sweeping scientific errors and was a one-sided portrayal of a complicated issue. If the issues weren't so serious and the ramifications so profound, I would have to laugh at it, said David Deming, a geology professor at the University of Oklahoma, who has been critical of media reporting on the climate change issue. In the article called "Obama Left with Little Time to Curb Global Warming," with a link for you, AP science writer Seth Borenstein wrote that global warming, quote, is a ticking time bomb that President-elect Barack Obama can't avoid. Global warming is accelerating. Deming, in an interview, took issue with Borenstein's characterization of a problem he says doesn't exist. He says global warming is accelerating. Not only is it continuing, it's accelerating, and whether it's continuing, that was completely beyond the evidence, Deming told FoxNews.com. The mean global temperature, the average global temperature, at least as measured by satellite, is now the same as it was in 1980. In the last couple of years, the sea level has stopped rising. Hurricane and cyclone activity in the northern hemisphere is at a 24-year low, and sea ice globally is also the same as it was in 1980. Deming said the article is further evidence of the media's decision to talk about global warming as fact, despite what he says is a lack of evidence. As I generally say, yes, there are catastrophic environmental problems. But the sun's heating up, and your car isn't melting the caps on Mars. If you want to stop me with a clipboard and ask me about stopping reckless cross-species engineering and GMO crops, then I might stop and talk to you. But it's a face-off now. The Washington Times. First U.S. face transplant done in Ohio. A woman so horribly disfigured she was willing to risk her life to do something about it has undergone the first near-total face transplant in the U.S., the Cleveland Clinic announced Tuesday. Of course, recently on MediaMonarchy.com, we noted folks from the Cleveland Clinic were on CNBC, and they were talking about how they should put medication in the water to help with high blood pressure and cholesterol. But, of course, one of the other talking heads notes that that would be a communist plot like fluoride. Anyway, reconstructive surgeon Dr. Maria Simonow and a team of other specialists replaced 80% of the woman's face with that of a female cadaver a couple of weeks ago in a bold and controversial operation certain to stoke the debate over the ethics of such surgery. The patient's name and age were not released, and the hospital said her family wanted the reason for her transplant to remain confidential. The hospital plans a news conference Wednesday, and we'll hear a little bit of that in a second. The transplant was the fourth worldwide. Two have been done in France, and one was performed in China, and now the first U.S. face transplant was performed in Ohio.
Doctors here at the Cleveland Clinic will be holding a press conference in a couple of hours to give us some more details about this historic surgery. At this point, we don't know much about the patient. We know she's a woman, but she's hoping to remain anonymous at this point. What we can safely surmise is that she was so badly disfigured that she was willing to risk her life to have this surgery. From what ABC News has learned, doctors replaced 80% of the patient's face using facial skin, nerves, and other tissue from a female cadaver in an operation that took place just a few weeks ago. And this is the lead surgeon, Dr. Maria Simonow. She's been carefully researching how to do this surgery for years. In 2006, while she was screening potential patients, she told ABC News that success would be an important medical milestone.
As important as giving a new life.
This is the fourth face transplant done worldwide, and apparently the most complete. The first was in 2005 on this French woman, Isabelle Dinoir. After her surgery, she told ABC's Barbara Walters what it was like to look in the mirror for the first time.
I thought it was going to be all bruised and swollen, that it was going to be ugly, but it was already wonderful.
So what will the new U.S. patient look like?
The hope of face transplants is to give someone a face which is as normal looking as possible.
But recovery is difficult and dangerous. Patients have to relearn how to use their face muscles. And they also have to take harsh immune-suppressing drugs for the rest of their lives to prevent rejection. Some bioethicists question whether it's right to perform life-threatening surgery for the sake of appearance. But many in the medical community have a different perspective.
Even though we say it is only for quality of life, for someone with severe facial deformity, it is almost life-threatening. It is almost impossible to live your life as we all do.
Here's a question a lot of people have about this surgery. Will the patient end up looking exactly like the donor? The answer is it's a mix of the donor's features and the patient's underlying bone structure. Fascinating stuff.
First U.S. face transplant performed in Ohio. Now, lastly, on this EnviroHealth tip, death maps, databanks, transplants, etc. from Alternet, a study shows that U.S. media keeps people uneducated about health issues. Blaming the media is a catchphrase that's used in almost cliche-level proportions, but when it comes to health care, a new study indicates that it may be appropriate to fault media coverage for a lack of public knowledge about health care policy. You can link to that report from journalism.org, the PDF link for you right there. By extension, the false perception of reproductive rights as ideological hot rods rather than women's health concerns. A recently released Pew Research study conducted with the Kaiser Family Foundation monitored health coverage from January 2007 to June 2008 to determine which subjects got the most coverage and in which media. The study was designed to be particularly broad-ranging. Rather than, for instance, analyzing how TV news covers breast cancer, the study looked at how television, radio, print, online, and other forms of media covered everything health-related, from specific diseases to health policy and more. What were the results? According to the report, quote, news about health occupies a relatively small amount of American news coverage across all platforms, 3.6% of news during 2007 and the first half of 2008. In a list of most frequently covered topics, health came in 8th, far above religion, education, and celebrities, but below the economy, crime, foreign affairs, and politics. These results, while hardly thrilling, don't seem abysmal at first. Health gets more coverage than celebrities, after all, which seems like a victory in our current climate. But compounding the small amount of attention devoted to health, the breakdown within existing health coverage shows a tendency to focus on controversial or sensational aspects of health issues, leaving vital policy information behind. One need only to think about the extreme health stories on the nightly news. Are your pills contaminated? Are your children at risk from a rare strain of... fill in the blank? So, you only need to think about the extreme health stories on the nightly news to understand the crux of the problem. Why focus on the actual public ramifications of various diseases and policies when Jenny McCarthy and Amanda Peter are going at it over autism? I'll admit, I fall victim to that myself in the things I sometimes post up or the things I find interesting. Of course, the important question to always ask... how many people does this actually affect? Lastly, on this B-side episode 103 of MediaMonarchy.com, latest episode from a man, Clyde Lewis, of the Ground Zero Lounge, recorded every Monday night in front of a live audience at Dante's Inferno in Portland, Oregon. Of course, the Ground Zero Lounge features Clyde Lewis and audience participation as they discuss current events as they relate to the paranormal. The most recent episode is called The Parable of the Acorns. While science incessantly debates global warming, perhaps it is time to debate global cleansing. Mother Nature is ready to purge herself of all the toxins, radioactive materials, and chemicals used by the elite to render the population ineffective and malleable, caught in the crossfire between nature and puppet master.
There are other things such as nature and acts of war that bring about your death, but those are things that, you know, you can't have control over. The war party continues to fill his chest, and people are all taking sides on who is evil and who isn't, who should live and who should be killed, who should we preemptively kill so they don't kill us. It's all fucking bullshit. I hope that there's Ground Zero listeners out here who believe that the whole war shit is shit. It's all there to get you riled. Yes, it's bullshit. No such thing as war. No, it's declared by these assholes and idiots who follow fight the wars. Wars are nothing more than ways to make money. It's grinding bodies and bones and blood to make cash. It's kicking the corpse for loose change. It's necromancy. It's evil. There's a reality Americans do not want to admit to, and that is that the ongoing effort of the military-industrial complex to defend us in the Middle East is actually killing us here at home. Look at the economy, for Christ's sake. We're still at war, but the economy's going down the toilet. Look, Tim Riley got fired today. Marconi got fired today. Look, people in radio don't get fired like this. They get fired if they say booger on the fucking air. They don't get fired just for walking in and doing their job, which these guys do. You do your job, you still get your fucking shaft. That's what your economy's like. Why? Because we have to fight wars in Afghanistan, fight wars in the Middle East, because these fucking Muslims are going to kill us all. Where the fuck are they? Why aren't they killing us now? Why didn't they kill like 5,000 instead of 3,000 in New York? They didn't because they can't. It's all bullshit. We are broke because these fuckers want to continue and grind bodies for fucking war chests. I'm fucking tired of hearing about who needs to kill who. It's not doing us any good because we're all dying here at home. And not only that, but the waste that they cause, the piles of bodies, the famine, the pestilence that they create with all those dead bodies. Well, you know what? All that byproduct has to go somewhere. It's not just going to flush down your toilet and you're going to forget about it. They're not going to recycle it. No. These diseases and these things that they put into the earth in the Middle East go places. And they don't just go in the water supply in the Middle East. What if I were to tell you that they've already started the nuclear war and they never told you? What if I told you that all this time we've been awaiting the dropping of the big one, but it has been the little ones that have been dropped all over time, making the planet a toxic nuclear wasteland?
Righteous anger from my man Clyde Lewis on the latest episode of the Ground Zero Lounge, The Parable of the Acorns. So we all know about the disappearance of the bees, but do you know about the disappearance of the acorns? So that's a Enviro Health related episode of Ground Zero Lounge with my man Clyde Lewis. Of course, go back, check out episode 100 of MediaMonarchy.com for an awesome two-hour interview in studio with Clyde Lewis. And that's going to do it for this B-side of 103 of MediaMonarchy.com. So much to go over. I'm going to be back in just a little bit for episode 104 of MediaMonarchy.com. I thank you, and I love you. Thanks for sticking through all this shit. It's kind of hard. There's a lot of changes. There's a lot of psychic warfare. It is ultimately a war on consciousness. But we can get through it together, my friends. And we're going to keep doing it here on MediaMonarchy.com. Like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
How would you explain it?
Combining music and stylized images.
It's all remote control.
Each one of those images was electronically based.
Say out on my threat.
And that concludes our program for tonight.
Yo. This could really catch on.
I can't remember when I've been so moved.